This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Across Northern Ireland, on your radio and on BBC Sounds. This is The Stephen Nolan Show!
Well, a very important Nolan show today. The Communities Minister, Gordon Lyons, in the studio a year on, making himself available and accountable to you through questioning. And the very sad story about John Cooney, the boxer who is now fighting for his life in intensive care. And the inevitable questions as to whether boxing can be made safer, whether that fight, Mr. Cooney's fight, should have been stopped earlier or not. And it's opinion in boxing, isn't it? Because how does anybody know? But all unfolding today on The Nolan Show.
The Stephen Nolan Show!
Good morning, everyone. Big show today. Here's our number, 03030 80 55 55 is the number to call this morning. And Gordon Lyons, the Minister, is here, the Communities Minister, is here in the studio with us this morning to talk through his first year in situ, whether he has delivered or not, and not just looking back, but I'll be encouraging the Minister to look forward over the next 12 months on another list of promises so that we can hold him and Stormont to account in 2026. First of all, we're going to look, though, before we get into the Minister's brief about what has happened on Saturday night and the Galway boxer John Cooney fighting now for his life. He's in critical condition in intensive care after he collapsed in Belfast on Saturday night. The former IBF super featherweight world champion Anthony Kakachi was commentating for the BBC on Saturday night. And the question, inevitably, the obvious question, inevitably, in boxing is, could more have been done? Can we make boxing safer? Should that fight have been stopped earlier? Here's Anthony Kakachi's opinion.
In my personal opinion, I thought the referee let him take way too much there. You know, a round or two, I should have been stopped. It's not good scenes in the ring right now. I'm just hoping that John Cooney recovers all right. But a great performance by Hal tonight, coming over here and doing this on another man's show. Have to commend him, but prayers for John Cooney at the minute.
Michaela, did you feel there was an argument, like Anthony Kakachi has said, for calling a halt to this one a little bit earlier?
I think so, and as you can see now in the corner, he's obviously taking a lot of time to recover. Just he was getting that extra punishment that he didn't need to be taken.
It's all about opinion. Michaela Walshler also giving opinion, Commonwealth Games gold medalist, part of the punditry team. I'm watching the same fight with a different opinion, the BBC's veteran commentator, Jim Neely, speaking to Good Morning Ulster this morning.
My thoughts went out to him immediately when I saw him looking distressed in the corner, and then I was able to see past the seconds, and then eventually he slipped into unconsciousness and fell onto the side of the ring or fell onto the canvas and had to be taken off in a stretcher. And I do say to myself sometimes, do I want to be sitting at ringside doing this for a living when young men are getting themselves hurt?
So we'll be looking at this and getting your commentary later, our thoughts again with the family and with John himself, and let's wish him a recovery. Minister Lyons, we're going to be talking about Stormont, but this story obviously talks about life and about sport. What are your initial views as we all think about what's been happening here?
Well, like most people, first and foremost, I think our thoughts will be with John and his family. This isn't something that we want to see happen. It's not something that we expect at all. And we need to make sure that we have high standards whenever it comes to safety and sport. Look, obviously, this is a contact sport. Sometimes these things do happen. It's awful when they do. We would want them to happen. We need to take all the steps that we can and appropriate measures to make sure that people are as safe as possible. But I think the different clips that you played there demonstrate the challenges for those involved. There are different opinions out there as to what should have happened, but I think it's right that you take time to look at it and see what, if anything, can be taken from this to make sure it can't happen again.
Do you think we should be looking again? You're the community's minister. Sports within your brief. Do you think we should be looking again at what is in place to protect boxers, given the context of what's happened here?
Well, absolutely. I think you have to realise just how serious this is. And look, I don't think it's for me as sports minister to say this is what must happen. I think that we have governing bodies, associations, different bodies that can look at this. But nobody wants this to happen to their family member or to anybody at all. So I hope that certainly we can look at this, see what, if any, lessons can be learned.
Okay. Look, we'll be coming back to that later in the programme. We'll be coming back to the fight and boxing. Carl Frampton will be joining us this morning in about half an hour's time, and obviously, and the promoter of the fight. So obviously we value the opinion of those people in the sport. Gordon, you're a year in situ. You've come into the Nolan studio. And first of all, I challenge a lot of you about where are you and are you accountable to the people? So thank you for coming in. Has it been a difficult year one? And do you think you've delivered?
Well, look, it's always challenging being in ministerial offices. It's a great privilege and an honour as well. But yes, I think that I have delivered. Now, I know that self-praise is no praise at all, or so I've been told. But don't listen just to me. Listen to the residents of the Victoria Square Apartments who have had redress to the courts now because of the legislation that I brought in, the Defective Premises Act. Listen to the housing associations and the homelessness charities who have warmly welcomed the fact that we now have a housing supply strategy in place so that we can take joined up action as an executive to build more desperately needed homes. Listen to those deaf charities who have warmly welcome the fact that after many years of promising from others, I have been the one that has brought forward sign language legislation that will make a real difference for a section of our community that often feel marginalised. Speak to the football clubs who've been waiting 14 years for the release of £36.2 million, the tens of thousands of people that has the potential to impact. Talk to the pensioners who under a Labour government were set to lose the entirety of their winter fuel allowance if they weren't on pension credit. And I have been able to secure funding that will mean that we will at least give something towards those pensioners. Speak to the musicians.
Any of those pensioners aren't going to get it in the winter. You've secured the funding and they haven't received it.
And I was only able...
Are they going to get it in the sunshine?
And I was only able to secure the funding. As I told you, I was on your show. I explained all of this. I secured the funding in November time. I didn't have access myself to the computer systems to pay this out. If it was up to me, Stephen, this money wouldn't have been cut at all. Everyone would have got the full amount. But I do what I can with what I have.
The money is being paid a day before spring starts.
But isn't that better than getting nothing at all?
Not for someone that's sitting in the freezing cold.
Well, I think that there is a certain degree of comfort knowing the fact that there is something coming along to help those in need. The alternative, Stephen, is that I sat back and said, this is too difficult. I might get criticism because it's not going to be into the end of the March. So therefore, I'll just sit back and do nothing. That's the difference of having a minister in office. I can actually say, no, I am going to do what I can with what I have. So I've given you a number of examples there.
Yeah.
Not what I'm saying, but what others have come and said to me. And I think that we actually have delivered.
And I only interrupted you once, and I want to walk through some of those different areas that you talked about. But in terms of that winter fuel allowance, if I just follow that up, does it not demonstrate a vulnerability in Northern Ireland that when a minister recognises, you recognise that people were vulnerable and you wanted to get money to them, and we couldn't. Northern Ireland PLC doesn't have a system in place to get money to people who we know are cold and freezing and vulnerable. So are we going to let that just roll, or are we going to fix that so that we can get money? If you're a government minister and you want to get resources to people quickly, you currently can't. That demonstrates that. So should Stormont be doing something about that?
No, look, of course that is difficult. And this is something that we realised during COVID as well, is that it actually is quite difficult to get money out to people and get money out quickly. Look, perhaps if we had had the funding in place and had a little bit more time, remember that Labour told us in July that this was first.
But I'm looking forward now. I'm saying for the next time, should something be done to fix it?
Absolutely. I think that we do need to find ways of helping people. And I can come on to more in a minute on this, but we did what we could as quickly as we could. And it was a challenge. It wasn't easy getting it to this stage, because you're dealing with an interface between the UK government and the Northern Ireland Executive and my own department. And we had to do an awful lot of work in a very constrained period of time to get it to this stage. But you talk about longer term solutions to these issues. And that's what I'm really interested in. I don't want to just be in a position where we're giving out short term help. I want to help people in the longer term. That's why I'm bringing forward a fuel poverty strategy. It's out to consultation at the minute, because I want longer term support for everybody in Northern Ireland, because I think everybody deserves to have a warm, safe home.
And support that will for everybody. Up.
Well, I want to make sure that everybody has a warm and safe home, and that means not just older people. There can be younger families. There are other people that are in need. So I want to make sure that we have the right building regulations, and that those are enforced, that we have energy efficiency focus, that we ensure that people can get access to the help that they need as well, and the advice that they need to make sure that they have a warm home. So that's a longer piece of work, but I want to make sure that people get the help that they need now, as well as into the future.
You've talked about big building regulations being enforced. I'm just curious about that. What does that mean? Does that mean a minimum standard of housing, and people have to do their houses up even if they can't afford it? That's what dinging in my brain there. Or what do you mean?
No,
being enforced?
I think what we need to make sure is that for those new builds in particular, that we raise and we enforce housing standards to make sure that our homes are built to a certain level.
What's wrong with the standards as current? Why raise the standards? What's wrong with new builds at the moment?
Well, I want to make sure that they're as energy efficient as possible. So the Housing Executive built for the first time in over 25 years new homes in North Belfast at Sunningdale, and they are to an exceptionally high standard, and it means that the energy bills are very, very low. Ultimately, that's what we should be looking to do. Now, we don't need to do something that's too onerous or makes it much more difficult to build homes, but sometimes we can put into place changes that may cost a little bit up front, but will save us much more in the longer term. Look, there is a cost of living crisis that is going on right now. We want to increase people's incomes, but we also want to reduce the money that is going out. That's why fuel poverty is so important, because energy is such a
thing. Fuel poverty strategy.
That's why, again,
anti-poverty strategy. We don't have one.
Well, we will very, very soon, because that was promised back in 1998. It was part of the Belfast Agreement and the 1998 Act. I will be bringing within weeks to the executive an anti-poverty strategy, and I'll be the first minister to deliver it.
And is that because, Gordon, you were taken to court because there wasn't one?
No, that didn't have any impact on it whatsoever. I came into office, it was a pledge that had been made, and it's something that I was progressing regardless of what is going on in the courts. That has had no impact on this process.
So help me understand then, tease this out for me. In that anti-poverty strategy, this new strategy, that the first thing have been done in what, decades?
Ever.
What's the game-changing components of it? You don't have to go into detail, but help us understand.
Okay. So there's going to be three pillars to it. This is what we're going to base all of the actions. And the most important thing is that we're working collectively as an executive, that we agree this is the way we need to go. We're all signing up to it. We all have our action points in place, and we get on with it and actually deliver it. I have zero interest, Stephen, in putting together a strategy that doesn't actually mean anything, or a strategy that just sits on a shelf. So first of all, we're going to put actions in place that prevent people from falling into poverty in the first place.
Make this real though. What's it mean? What type of actions? How could you do that?
Different types of help and assistance. Let me go through these first. Preventing people from falling into poverty, helping those that are experiencing poverty, and helping people get out of poverty as well. So how do we prevent people from getting into poverty? Education is really important. Improving the health system. Making sure that people are fit and able to work. And work is at the centre of all of this. If we want to get people out of poverty, the best thing that we can do is help people get into work. And that's the focus that I'm going to have within this strategy. Now, I want to make sure that there's the funding that comes behind that to support it, to make sure that we can make a real difference in people's lives.
You just can't create jobs. It's a good overview, but you can't just create jobs from nowhere and help people at the very bottom of the earning cycle. You can't dictate the wage. You can't create the jobs, can you?
We have the jobs. We have many jobs in Northern Ireland, and we can't get people to fill them. And oftentimes, that's because there are people that are available for work, but there are barriers to them getting into employment. And I want to put the help and support.
Barriers like what?
Can make a difference. Let me give you an example. We have a program that I'm very, very proud of in the department, JobStart, that helps people get in to work. It was probably one of the most memorable visits that I have done as a minister. What we do is we provide tailored support to people who have not been in work for a long time, can't get into work, have found it difficult to maintain employment. And they go through this program within my department. This is a good news story, by the way, that you never hear and the public never get to hear. But I met some of them. Some of them came to work in the civil service. And I remember speaking to a young man who said he had autism, and he said, I never thought I'd be able to get a job. And his parents were really concerned about him. There's someone who's now in the civil service doing a work, a type of work that is really well suited to him. But that took time, effort, money to give that person tailored support. What are you good at? What do you like to do? How can we help you? And that person has now got a job. So there's many different scenarios, but we need to help people get into work. And that is one of the most important things that we can do to help tackle poverty.
It's the yin and the yang, isn't it? So those people who want to work and finding money to encourage them to get into work, what about those people who you will hear being talked about on radio programmes like this who don't want to work and they want to sit and they want to milk the system? What are you going to do with that?
Well, it's not acceptable.
But what are you going to do to find them, identify them?
Well, and we are working on that, and I've had very good conversations already with the UK government, with Liz Kendall and other members of her ministerial team, because a lot of this is based on the welfare system that we have at the minute as well. So you need to work with London, because they're the one that set the rules. But yeah, absolutely, there needs to be the carrot and the stick to help people.
So what might the stick be?
Into work. Well, look, you need to make sure that you're in a position where there is incentive for people to get into work. You need to be better off in work than you do in benefits. And all too often, that's not the case right now.
So does that, again, practically, would that mean people being paid more, or would that mean benefits going down? Or how do you encourage those people who, it annoys people, the hardworking people of this country? And I'm not talking here, by the way, to be very clear, nor are you, about people on benefits who are entitled to those benefits and can't work and wish they could. But for those people who milk the system, how are you going to make a change in Northern Ireland so that they can be stopped milking the system?
Well, we need to make sure that we're in a position where it's better off for people to be in work, and making sure
that, how are you doing that?
Making sure that they can get into those jobs. But look, a lot of this policy responsibility doesn't lie directly with this department. A lot of this lies with the Department for Work and Pensions.
But hold on, you're better off, Minister, on benefits in Northern Ireland than anywhere else in the UK. Should that be the case?
In what way?
Well, you're better off financially on benefits than anywhere else in the UK.
How so?
You extended the extension of welfare mitigation payments as an example.
Yeah. So
there is a difference.
The reason why that was done was because, take the bedroom tax, for example. We don't have the housing stock in Northern Ireland to allow us to get to the position where people have an alternative. So it's simply not the case that we have enough homes where people say, OK, the home that I'm in is too big for me at the minute. I'll move to another home. Often that doesn't exist. That's where the big problem lies. So that's why we mitigated that, for example, because the impact on that would be hard on the people, but they didn't have an alternative route to go down.
And can you afford to continue that mitigation?
Well, we can. The executive has made that money available.
But much as a cost, it's coming from our pot.
Well, look, there was a sum set aside of £48 million to cover those additional measures. Look, of course, it's not ideal. We would rather that we didn't have to take money from elsewhere to put it in there, but we're just not in the position, Stephen, where we would be able to put people into the homes. The homes aren't available.
You mentioned housing. I said on the programme, Gordon, yesterday, day before, that, look, I completely, 100%, this programme does it too. I understand why health is often at the top of the agenda in terms of how's the minister going to deliver and waiting lists, because it affects all our lives, man, woman, children, and so it goes on. But housing, I'm not sure housing gets the traction in this country that it should. It affects the poorest. It affects our easily identifiable areas where people are really, really struggling. What are you going to do, because this is your brief, about providing safe, good housing in Northern Ireland so that people can actually get up in the morning and feel that they've got a chance in life with a safe roof over their head?
Yes, you're absolutely right. It doesn't get the attention that it needs. And we talk a lot about health and education in Northern Ireland, but I don't think that we realise that in order to have better health and educational outcomes, a safe, secure, warm home is absolutely a building block for those and for everything else that we want to do in society. So let's talk action. Let's talk about the things that I have actually done, because I recognise that this has been a crisis. And I have to say, I think that I've done more in the year that I've been in office than has been done in a long time in terms of any ministerial direction and work in this area. So, headline, yes, absolutely, we now have a housing supply strategy where everybody's joined up and we're all working together.
Well, how many houses are you going to build this year?
Well, we're going to build 100,000 over the next 15 years. But we also...
Yeah, but how many are you going to build this year is my question.
Well, we're going to start on 1,400. At the start of this year, we thought we were only going to build 400 homes, but with the extra money that I've been able to leverage in, that's now going to be 1,400 homes.
But which is a drop in the ocean of what's needed.
It absolutely is. And we need to see a number of other things happening. Most importantly, we need to see, and this is where London need to step up and help, at little to no cost to them, we need them to change the rules that are in place so that the housing executive can borrow against its assets and build more homes. That's what we need to see happen, and that will be a game changer. In the meantime, I have taken action. So, for example, to help in housing, I have brought in something new that has never been done before in Northern Ireland. It's called intermediate rent. And essentially what we're doing is using cheaper government borrowing, financial transactions capital, which we always seem to send loads back to London every year. I'm starting to utilise that now to allow developers to build homes with this cheaper government borrowing on the basis that they rent it back to those who are in need at a discounted rate of 20%. Real action that way, and many other areas as well. We're doing new and innovative things.
Well, two things in that. You've got a problem when you talk about developers building homes. Mm-hmm. If you don't change the planning system mm-hmm. in this country, it is a devolved issue.
Yes.
Builders can't build homes. They can actually get to the point of having the planning permission in place, and the homes can't connect to our water infrastructure. So guess what? Builders are sitting on projects for 3, 4, 5 years. You know this.
Yes.
So has the executive sat down and sorted the planning system? There's no point if you haven't.
Well, this is exactly why we have a plan now in place, that we have the housing supply strategy, which is saying housing is a priority for us. Here's how we're going to work together to get this done. And we're going to have action plans in the coming months so that we can start to implement change in this area.
But if we don't improve our water infrastructure and investment, the homes won't be built, Gordon.
And Stephen, this is the point that I have been making as well. I get that. I understand the need to change not just wastewater issues and the ability to connect, but also making sure that we are connecting where there is capacity in the system, and there is still capacity in the system. But also, planning is so slow in Northern Ireland, and it needs to improve, and it hasn't improved yet. And that's why I think we need to see much more action there.
But you look, I'm also talking to you today, not just about your brief, but you are one of the people in that wider executive where there is collective responsibility. Your plan goes nowhere if the executive as a body does not sort water infrastructure in Northern Ireland and change planning. It goes nowhere.
Yes.
So have you been able to negotiate with the wider executive, and is there anything that's going to happen in 2025 to change the water infrastructure capability or indeed planning. So, and Northern Water is saying, by the way, they need an extra billion.
So this is why we have a cross-departmental document, such as the housing supply strategy, in place, so that we can identify the actions that need to be taken. And we're going to have that in an action plan within months, so that we can set out what it is that we need to do. Look, you're making the exact same case as I am.
Where are we getting the billion from?
That's
Or where are NI Water getting it from?
You're making the exact same case that I am making every single week to executive colleagues to make sure that we can improve that. I want to see that happen. I don't.
But if you're making it every week and it still hasn't happened, there's a fundamental problem.
Yeah, no. Absolutely.
Well, who's blocking it?
Absolutely. Well, look, that's also a question for the infrastructure minister as well, about how we need to tackle these issues. But we absolutely need to find a way forward.
Is someone in the executive blocking it? What is needed to happen in Northern Ireland? Developers will be punching their radios at the moment listening to this. Is there anyone in the executive blocking water infrastructure reform or planning reform?
Well,
and if not, why is it not being done?
Well, look, I know that there are challenges in getting this sorted. You know about the investment that is needed as well. But look, we're determined to work together to try and solve this. I don't think there are necessarily any easy fixes, but absolutely. I hope that the infrastructure minister will be bringing forward proposals, because this is absolutely critical to doing what we need to do and what we need to achieve. So I hope that proposals will be brought forward and we will look at those.
And just before we leave housing, intimidation points,
yep.
Housing intimidation points, you're scrapping that.
Yes.
How can you justify that for those people who are under genuine threat in Northern Ireland?
Well, those that are under threat in Northern Ireland should all be treated the same. I think most people would recognise that, whether you are under threat from a paramilitary organisation, whether it's on the basis of your race, or whether it's because you've been subjected to domestic abuse. Whatever it is, I think everybody should be treated the same. And Stephen, I've made a lot of announcements during my time in post, but I have never had the reaction that I have had to this issue. It has been welcomed from across the political spectrum and those that are involved in housing. And why wouldn't it? This levels up. This ensures that people are treated the same, whether you're a victim of domestic violence or whether you're a victim of paramilitary activity. It's levelling the playing field. It's the right thing to do.
A year in, Casement Park, many people from within the GAA community just wondering if you have a motive against the building of a stadium that would service so many young and elderly people and the community. So the straight question is, are you prepared to put more money in? And have you had any more chats with GAA which would indicate they're prepared to put more money in?
Look, let's get right to the heart of this. And I'm glad you've raised this, because I get this time and time again. A commitment was made in 2011. I absolutely stand by that commitment.
Yeah, but the issue, though, Gordon.
Yes, I understand that. I get that. But
so will you upgrade the commitment to at least allow for inflation?
Well, hang on a second first. I think we need to understand, because there's a lot of accusations that are thrown about around this issue. And I want to take this opportunity to put a few things straight, because I get the criticism that this hasn't gone ahead because I'm a unionist minister and I don't want to do anything for the GAA. So I just want to knock that on the head right now. This has been going on for 14 years. The money was first promised in 2011. Windsor Park had the work done. Ravenhill had the work done. The money was available for Casement, but it wasn't held up by me or by any other unionist politician. It was held up not because of the Andersonstown Road branch of the DUP either, by the way. It was by the residents in that area. It was because of judicial reviews. It was because of issues around safety certificates in 2005. There were not unionist ministers in charge of the department at that time. So that needs to be put on the record very, very clearly, first of all. Now, fast forward to a year ago. And I was in the position where the Euros was being discussed. It was considered as an option to have the Euros in Belfast for Casement Park. But the sums of money hadn't increased, but the cost of the stadium had ballooned. And partly that was because of inflation, but partly that was because of the Euros and the additional cost that it would be required to get a UEFA level stadium done at that time.
You see, what you're doing, and I understand why you're doing it, but what you're doing is rehearsing all that's happened, all the reasons why.
Because context is important.
Built. It is, absolutely.
Okay.
But I reckon just as important a question is, we are where we are in 2025. What are you doing to get that stadium built?
Okay, so...
are you prepared to put more money in?
Well, I cannot, from my own budget, say I'm going to give extra money here. I don't have the budget to do that. I don't have the authority to do that.
You do have the authority to do it.
Not if I don't have the money, Stephen.
Well, it's about choices. It's about choices.
So I'm going to stop building houses for the next 3 or 4 years in order to pay for what the additional cost might be. You know, come on, you have to be realistic.
So what do you think the realistic option is? Have you asked the GAA to increase their contribution, and what have they said?
So they have said they're going to increase their contribution. They said they wouldn't at the start, but they've now said that that's something that they're prepared to look at. I haven't had confirmation of what that will be. So there are two things here. There's the money that's available and the plans that are currently on the table as well. I don't think anybody's asking any more for the level of fitting out of the stadium that would have been required for the Euros. So that takes a little bit away from the cost. But if we're still talking about a 34,000 fully seated stadium, as per the planning permission that's on the table, that's still going to cost a lot of money. And there's a gap, there's a shortfall. So I've met with the GAA. We're meeting again soon to discuss what other options might
look like. But what do you think? What I'm wondering here is, do we have a government minister sitting in front of me that is prepared to put an option on the table rather than just talk about non-identifiable options? So what do you think should be built, and how much do you think your department should be contributing?
Well, first of all, whether it came to football, rugby or the GA, it's not for the minister to say, here's what I think you need.
But we've got an impasse here going back 14 years.
Yeah, but this has always been about the sporting organisations coming forward and saying, this is the need that we have. Now, we will be looking at options, and my officials have been working to consider what other options might be out there. But I think we have to recognise what we have at the minute is a gap between the money that's on the table and between the plans that are currently there. And you either need to see an increase in contributions, or you need to see the plan scale back, or a combination of both.
And what do you think should happen?
As Minister, I'm happy to talk through those. Ultimately, the only commitment that I have, and the only commitment that I have made, is that we will release the funding that is currently there. But we're happy to discuss all those options through with the GAA or anybody else.
Let's look at rates reform. So Caoimhe Archibald, our Finance Minister, has Caoimhe already left post or going to?
I think she's gone,
She's gone, is she? She wants to raise the cap on rates to £485,000. So this is basically people in big homes, and their rates are being assessed against a 400 grand cap. Caoimhe wants to raise it. The BBC understands that the DUP is blocking that. Is that accurate?
Well, look, I just think that if we're talking about wider reform of...
I'm talking about rates reform?
Of rates.
And the question
is
the DUP
other,
blocking it?
If we're talking about rates reform or wider reform, I think we have to take into consideration the fact that right now, many, many people are finding it tight, that I think we're already taxed to death. And I think that any increase on this... would need to be very, very carefully considered. And
the question is a simple one, so that we all know, so that we can all feed into the debate. Is the DUP blocking the proposal for the rates cap to increase?
Well, we didn't block anything, because the finance minister didn't need executive approval to go out to consultation.
Do you support the rates
which is what she did. Look, we'll take all of these things under consideration, but none of this is straightforward. And on the wider point, I think that we're already taxed significantly.
But look, taking things under consideration is a politician's answer with respect when you don't want to answer the question. And what I'm trying to do with you today is, you're being good enough to come in here, sit in front of your electorate. And so I think it's fair for them to know, Is it your view, as I think you're nearly setting out, that you're going to protect people from against that tax increase? You're going to fight to protect them? Or you think Northern Ireland needs that money and it has to happen? So which is it? Just clear talking to the people who listen to this programme.
No, what I'm saying is I think that before we consider some of these other options in terms of revenue raising, that we need to make sure that we're spending the money that we have now in the right way, and that we're not putting undue burden on people. And I take that as a general principle around all of these issues in regards to revenue raising.
What are going to be your big... You've spelled out some things at the top of this interview today that you have delivered. What are your big aspirations for year two now that you want to deliver?
Well, I think that I want to continue actually making a difference in the things that matter. So that's why getting the anti-poverty strategy delivered is important, why ensuring that we continue to make progress with the commitments that I've made in regards to housing supply as well. And all of those policies that actually make a change and a difference in people's lives, that's what I'm focused on doing.
So, like, have you targets?
Well, we will have targets. It'll be coming through from the housing supply strategy, from the fuel poverty consultation, whenever it is it's completed as well. And you'll see the wider targets that come from the work within the wider programme for government.
You mentioned, sometimes when I'm doing an interview, I haven't thought of a question, and now I have, which is, you mentioned earlier about helping people back into work.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been watching the Trump administration saying, you want to work in the public sector in America? Get into work, don't work from home. What's your view on that as a government minister?
Well, look, I think there's huge benefit of being in the office. I think that remote working or hybrid working, depending on your job, can work for maybe a day or two in the office. But ultimately, as a rule, I think it's better for people to be in the workplace, to be around their colleagues, to chat to them.
So will you be issuing that rule?
To think things through. Well, look, those are wider issues for the civil service themselves.
If you're a government minister, you can give an instruction.
But within the Department for Communities, we're back to at least 40%. And many are in full-time. Some that are involved in benefit delivery don't need to be in as much because their interactions are primarily with customers that they can do over the phone or by email. But I think there's huge benefit in making sure that you're in the office, that you're chatting to other people, that you're around your colleagues as well.
And have you if I was to ask you, what are your top three priorities that you're sitting here today? Hopefully you'll come back in a year's time and I'll be able to say, did you deliver?
Mm-hmm.
What would they be, Minister?
Well, it's the progression of what we've outlined within the housing supply strategy, because I believe housing is absolutely critical to making sure that people get that good start in life. I want people to have more money in their pockets. I want to help working families, which is why I want to make real progress in terms of fuel poverty and making sure that we can get those extra measures in people's homes so they can save more money and they're not spending more on energy.
Is that grants for insulation?
It can be grants for insulation, yeah, that can be part of it. We obviously have the affordable warm scheme at the minute, so it's looking at how we can do more around that area to help people save, to make sure people are making good choices as well as when it comes to energy usage as well.
And do you think those grants should be universal, or should they be at the most needy, or where do you see those grants?
I think those need to be for people who are in need and for those that wouldn't otherwise. You know, government in a way should always be the last resort when there's no other help available, and I think it's fair and right that we're helping people. And those that are really struggling, those that are out working every day and don't have some of the same level of support as other people, those are the people that I want to help. Those that go out every single day and feel as if they're the ones that don't get any help along, because that goes such a long way. See the energy efficiency of homes, it's an absolute game changer for people.
What are relations like with Sinn Féin?
Well, look, I have a very professional working relationship with Sinn Féin. I think you can see that through the work that we have done so far, and with the other parties as well. Take the Defective Premises Act piece of legislation I went through that ended up helping the Victoria Square apartments. That needed people to work together. So myself, Keith Archibald, the Finance Minister at that stage, Andrew Muir in Agriculture, we sat down together in a very collegiate way to try and get things done, and we did.
Michelle O'Neill says Emma Little Pengelly and her are friends. Are you friends with anyone in Sinn Féin?
I don't think that's how I would characterise the relationships.
Why not?
With Sinn Féin.
Do you not make friends in work?
I do sometimes make friends and work, but
it's not with Sinn Féin.
It's not something I think of in that way. I go into work and I do a job. Are you friends with any of them in Sinn Féin?
I'm not friends with any of you.
Why not?
Because I think I need an arm's length relationship.
Very interesting.
With all of you.
Very interesting.
Arm's length.
Very interesting.
Mr. Lyons, can I ask you this? You've no tie on today. Edward Poots is talking about the dress code. What do you make of that? When the speaker has been saying, look, I want you in Stormont in a certain dress. And I look, there's a formality to that. There's maybe a respectability, a respect for the institution. But yet lots of people who vote for their politicians don't wear shirts and ties every day. Where do you stand on that?
Well, look, first of all, apologies for not showing the same deference and respect to the Nolan Show and to the studios that do the Assembly.
You should be wearing a tie.
Look, I agree with Edwin on this, actually. I think that we're doing serious work. I think that it's a huge privilege, and I am privileged every day to be able to represent my constituents in
it?
East Antrim. Oh, I love my job.
Why?
I love my job because within this department, I feel that we're able to do things that actually make a difference. And that's what I'm all about. That's why I am involved in politics, because you want to try and do things and you want to make things better. And I feel that throughout the time in office, I've been able to do things which have made a difference. And I know I've been listing off some of my achievements, but, you know, the excitement. I had somebody come up to me the other day saying how pleased they were that we're taking the sign language bill forward. Olympic celebration event that I had for Olympians and Paralympians, I had athletes came up to me. They weren't medal winners, but they said, you've recognised us. And the
but with all of that Olympic success, all of that, Minister, I know you need to go, but with all of that Olympic success, have you followed through with money? With more opportunity for those people, given what they've shown?
Yes.
You've given 100 grand?
100 grand? No, that's only the start. 100 grand was for the medalists as a token of recognition for what it is they have done. But next year I'll be bringing forward an Olympic Legacy Fund, where I'll be putting money into sport to try and help people that are trying to get to the next level. Well, you're going to have to invite me back on so I can tell you that much, but it will be in the millions of pounds to help people. So
your invites are interesting. I will not be going cold water swimming with you, let me assure you.
I know, that's only for Mark Simpson.
I see.
You're not up for that at all.
Final question.
Okay.
I'm the Secretary of State. Hilary Benn, we understand, is essentially going to say to Northern Ireland, look, stop moaning about money, get on with it. And I dare say that he might be asking, where's your programme for government?
Yeah.
What would you say back to the Secretary of State?
Well, the first thing that I would say is that Northern Ireland has not had sufficient funding for many, many years. We have been underinvested, and Gavin Robinson first raised this issue years ago, and others have started to recognise that as well. Now, the Secretary of State apparently today is going to say that reform is needed. And I agree, reform is needed, but there needs to be a recognition that reform requires investment. We need money for those upfront costs so we can make those longer term decisions that will give us money in the longer term. So that's what I hope we'll actually see from him, is a bit of recognition of the difficulties that we're in, because when we're in such a constrained...
It's just giving you loads of money when you went back in the Stormont.
But when we're in such a constrained budgetary environment, I can tell you we do not feel flush right now with the pressures that we are facing. And when you're under those pressures, it's very, very difficult for us to put funding aside and in place to do that investment for the long-term reform that we need. So I don't think you'll find anybody in the executive that says, no, we're not up for changing the way we do things. But the barrier has often been the upfront cost that's required to make those changes.
Do you think it would be a disgrace if there's no programme for government when you're back here, hopefully this time next year?
This time next year, yes.
So when do you think we should have...
Well, I have been working closely in my own department preparing our sections for that. As you'll be aware, we've now for the first time got a commitment in the draft programme for government for housing as a standalone item. Look, there's been a lot going on the last couple of weeks with the storm and everything else, but I believe we'll make progress on that very, very soon.
Your people are going to kill me because you have to go.
But said last question I a few have, times but now, but I'm happy to do this.
Okay, but there's one more question, and it is that I understand through sources to this programme that there is a report on your desk about councillors' pay, and that even from within your own party, I understand that you have been put under pressure to raise the cap on councillors' pay, and then it's for councillors to vote themselves how much they get. So are you going to raise the cap? I know that some councillors have been looking 15% of a pay increase. Are you going to allow that to happen?
Well, look, when it comes to councillor pay...
That's my final question, I promise.
When it comes to councillor pay, there has been a report that's presented to me by an independent independent body that did that that piece of work. Look, let me assure, I hope everybody, when it comes to the issue of councillor pay, first of all, I believe that it should be fair. Fair to taxpayers, fair to councillors, and I think it needs to be benchmarked against where public sector pay has been as well.
That's so been about 5%.
So that gives you an indication of where things are at. However, I do have a problem with how this works at the minute. Your listeners probably think differently, but here's the truth. MPs don't vote on their own pay. MLAs don't vote on their own pay. But currently, councillors have to decide whether they accept the maximum limit or not. I think that's wrong. I think that needs to change.
So change it. You're a minister. So,
well, that's what I'm about to do, Stephen. I'm about to bring a paper to executive colleagues saying to them that I think this needs to change, and I'm going to be asking for the authority to bring through a bill to enable that power to be taken away from councillors. They do not set their own pay.
So this year, 5% in the future, take away the power from them.
Well, I'm saying it's being benchmarked against public sector pay. That's your figure. That's not mine.
What is your figure?
Well, I'm going to be telling executive colleagues first with all due respect. All right. It's not one for the Nolan Show. But yes, I think we need to take that power away from councillors, because I don't think that's fair on them, and I don't think it's what the public want to see either.
I said it for years. Why don't government ministers come in and speak to the people? You're speaking, you know, to many people this morning. Thank you so much for doing so. And I hope you'll be back, Gordon, okay? Race up the road.
I will.
You've got a meeting, 10:15. Blame me.
Thanks. I will.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay, 10 to 10, 030-30-80-55-55 is the number to call this morning. To the boxing next, boxer John Cooney is in intensive care after a fight at the Ulster Hall on Saturday night. John collapsed during the fight. He was stopped by the referee in the 9th round in what was Cooney's first defence of his Celtic super featherweight title. The veteran BBC commentator Jim Neely has told Good Morning Ulster this morning that what he saw has made him question commentating on boxing. The former professional boxing champion Carl Frampton is with us this morning. Good morning to you, Carl.
Morning, Stephen.
Good morning. What are your thoughts as the sport that you so love, and you understand the risks in every boxer does, yeah, but it has led now to John in intensive care?
Well, it's horrible. It really is. And my heart goes out to John and his family and anyone else involved in boxing who's ever suffered like John has. It's obviously one of the downsides to our sport, a sport that can be very brutal at times. And it's just not nice. I don't know a lot more to say than that, but it's extremely sad.
And inevitably, Carl, people will be looking at that fight and they'll be asking all the very obvious and reasonable questions. Should the referee have stopped the fight earlier? Should someone else have stopped it earlier? How can we make this sport safer?
Yeah, well, I mean, I can't comment on the fight because I actually didn't see it. I was at an event with my family on Saturday night, so I missed the fight. So I can't comment on should it have been stopped by the referee earlier, should it have been stopped by the corner earlier. But there is certainly instances that I have seen where I actually like fights have went on too long. Well, of coming back from winning. And whether that's the fault of the corner, I suppose it's probably a combination of both the corner and sometimes the referee doing that. But for the most, I would say that the trainers in the corner and referee are getting it right and stopping them before there's too much damage. Obviously, you know, what happened to John Cooney is heartbreaking. But like I said, this is one of the horrible risks in the sport that I love so much.
And look, you commentate regularly now. You've been there. You're a boxing champion. Do you think safety is as good as it can be?
I'm not quite sure, if I'm being honest. I think that more can be done in terms of nutrition, and I think a lot of the damage is done when fighters, obviously it's a weight-making sport, you know, going into weigh-ins, which are a day and a half before a fight, severely dehydrated. Sometimes a day and a half isn't enough to get yourself hydrated enough for it to be a safe level. So the Board of Control, they actually have these check weigh-ins, you know, a month out, 2 weeks out or whatever, to make sure you're in a certain distance. But I know for a fact that the fighters cheat these weigh-ins.
And we're talking generally here. We're not talking about this fight, obviously.
No, I'm not talking about this fight. I'm talking about fighters generally. So, there probably is. There is ways that it could be safer. You know, people talking about head guards and stuff. I don't think head guards makes it actually safer. There's been research done to show that head guards only really stop cuts from happening, not, you know, trauma to the head or brain. But I think nutrition needs to be looked at, and I think that's where a lot of these serious injuries are kind of stemming from.
What is the pressure on the boxer and the family in terms of the thoughts of, look, this is what you dedicate your life to, but there's that inherent risk in the background?
I think if, as a fighter anyway, you probably just put it to the back of your mind. You know that there is a risk, and if you actually sat there and thought about it, you know that you're in a dangerous sport. But for me, it was something I never really thought about. And while I was boxing, I was doing it to better the life of my family, my wife and kids, and even my mum and dad or whoever else. And I obviously wanted to win titles and stuff. But for me, it was about security. Especially as my career developed, and I've been one of the lucky ones, Stephen, that I have a secure life for the time being, and my kids are in a good position. But there's few and far between. So I would class myself as one of the very, very lucky ones.
Did you ever worry about it?
No. I never did, honestly. And
is it a case where maybe now you look back and think, I should have worried about that? Carl? Was there ever a fight where looking back now you think maybe that was really risky?
No, not necessarily. I mean, I did have fights where I fought the wrong fight and maybe took too many punches that I didn't have to take. And sometimes that's down to trying to impress the crowd a wee bit, but I never thought about that. And I think you just put it to the back of your mind. Now, looking back, I probably sparred too much. I think that I done too many rounds sparring. I sparred guys that were too big for me as well. And at the time, I got a bit of a macho feel out of that. But thinking back now, in hindsight, I probably wouldn't have sparred as much. It's just trauma on your head and brain that you don't need.
And do you, look, this is a personal question, duck it or answer it whatever way you want, Carl. Do you now, is there anything with you, memory, headaches, anything with you where you're thinking that's because of the living I had, the job I did? No.
My memory has never been any good, Stephen. So that's something Mum and Dad will always tell you. But I, it's something that I wouldn't say I worry about it. But I've been to see some specialists just to have my brain checked out, just to make sure it's kind of working as it should be, and there's no deterioration in it. And I've seen a doctor, and I go back on a yearly basis to do a kind of a checkup to just make sure that cognitively I'm still okay, and you know, touch wood, at this stage I'm still okay. But to be honest, I'm probably expecting, you know, the longevity and of my career and how long I was in boxing, I'm expecting at some point that I will have dementia or some sort of brain injury. But I'm just hoping it's when I'm 75 years old and not 50.
My goodness. So you're expecting dementia because of boxing?
Probably, if you look at what's going on in the sport and the amount of former fighters that this happens to, I was someone who sparred quite a lot, but I'm okay with it. Like, I'm not worried. Obviously, I hope that I don't get it.
But does it change how you live your healthy life, in that you think to yourself, right, well, there might be a time where I don't know who I am?
I suppose it does. I wouldn't want to be a burden on anyone or anything like that. I know this is getting very deep now, the conversation, but sure. It is a serious subject. But it's something that it's part of the game, and it's a horrible thing to say. That sounds very flippant, but if you're in the professional boxing, and I'm going to separate professional boxing and amateur boxing, because I think amateur boxing is actually quite a safe sport, where referees jump in quicker and stop fights if kids are hurt, bigger gloves and so on. But it's the professional side of the game which can be very, very, very brutal.
Listen, you've been very honest and open today, and we value your opinion, Carl, on this, because, one, you're one of us, and you continue to be a champion, sir. So thanks so much for coming on the programme. Really appreciate it. Well, I think that's quite a revealing interview from Carl Frampton. He's expecting to have dementia because of boxing, and he's saying that there could be extra safety measures put in place. Really interesting stuff there. We'll continue this after 10. Good morning and thanks for joining us today. The super featherweight boxer John Cooney is in intensive care after his fight on Saturday night. The contest was stopped in the 9th round at the Ulster Hall. Here's how the BBC's boxing commentator Jim Neely described the end of the contest.
And Nathan Hawes is coming forward trying to end this with 20 seconds to go, and it's been stopped. And what a turn up and what a surprise, because John the Kid Cooney was meant to win this one and go on to British title challenging, but he hasn't done it. It's been stopped in the 9th round, and you couldn't actually argue with that.
The former IBF super featherweight world champion Anthony Kakachi and the Commonwealth Games gold medalist Michaela Walsh were part of the BBC's punditry team. They were asked if the fight should have been stopped sooner.
In my personal opinion, I thought the referee let him take way too much there. You know, a round or two, it should have been stopped. It's not good scenes in the ring right now. I'm just hoping that John Cooney recovers all right. But a great performance by Hal tonight, coming over here and doing this on another man's show. Have to commend him, but prayers for John Cooney at the minute.
Michaela, did you feel there was an argument, like Anthony Kakachi has said, for calling a halt to this one a little bit earlier?
I think so, and as you can see now in the corner, he's obviously taking a lot of time to recover. Just he was getting that extra punishment that he didn't need to be taking.
The BBC's boxing commentator Jim Neely spoke to Good Morning Ulster this morning.
My thoughts went out to him immediately when I saw him looking distressed in the corner, and then I was able to see past the seconds, and then eventually he slipped into unconsciousness and fell onto the side of the ring or fell onto the canvas and had to be taken off in a stretcher. And I do say to myself sometimes, do I want to be sitting at ringside doing this for a living when young men are getting themselves hurt?
John's manager, Mark Dunlop, is with me this morning. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Steve.
Good morning, Mark. Nice to speak to you. Can you share with us how he is?
Yes. So basically, from obviously Saturday night, we've been back and forward to the Royal Victoria Hospital. John is in a very, very critical condition at this point, and the next 24 hours will be very crucial to how this nightmare for everybody, including John's family, pans out. Does that make sense?
And look, our thoughts and our respect to the family and to John, and everybody wishes that he pulls through here.
Yeah.
What happened?
So basically, obviously, if I can start from the beginning, it was a very evenly matched contest. The two guys had similar records. None of the guys were particularly renowned punchers, meaning like there were more boxers than it was likely to go like the full distance, you know, and the best boxer won. And that's how things were going. But as it panned out, the first round, John nearly, if there had been another 10 seconds, it would be a different scenario. John would have won the contest. He had Hiles out on his feet, more or less. But then Hiles come back and it was nip and tuck for a few rounds, and then obviously Hiles then started to pull away. On the 9th round, I heard the referee. I was sitting in the other side of the ring. I was at the side where the Hiles team were sitting, And I clearly heard the referee saying a couple of times to John, if you don't show me something, John, you know, I'm going to stop it. He did give John every opportunity. John went down with a body shot. He got up. And then, obviously, as every boxer would do, they know their fighter's about to be taken out. So they come and have one last flurry, and that's whenever the fight was stopped. And it was fight. It was, to be fair. And I'm John's manager, and obviously we're rooting for John to win. You know, in a boxing match, the only person that can stop the fight is the referee. You know,
well, that's not technically true, is it? The corner can stop the fight.
Well, they can throw the towel in, as indeed
the boxer themselves, unlikely as it is, can stop a fight.
Yeah. Well, they can throw the towel in, and the referee
and a doctor can stop a fight too.
Yes, but at that stage,
or advise that they're concerned. And I am not in any way. Let me just be very clear.
Yeah.
I am not talking about this particular fight. I'm talking in general about how it works.
Yes, yes. So in real, but the actual final decision is on the referee. So if so in the rules of boxing, a corner can say that's enough, and the referee has to accept that. I've seen fights where the towel's been thrown in, and the referee's kicked it back out because, you know, there's only so many seconds left in a fight or whatever, but as you know yourself, it only takes a second. But, you know, so basically, obviously, we all know what happened. Then John was put on on the chair and given oxygen, and that's whenever everything that has transpired now has came to fruition. He was sick and taken to hospital. But
and he has an injury on his brain. Is that right?
Yeah. So he has a bleed to the brain. So basically, there's a bleed to the brain, and obviously he had an operation to relieve the pressure that was caused by swelling in the brain caused by the bleed. So he's now in intensive care in the Royal Victoria Hospital.
And are you saying to me? And look, I'm trying to be as sensitive as possible here. He has a family, and we need to respect him as well.
Yes.
But are you saying to me that the medical professionals have said the next 24 hours are critical?
Yes. That's how bad this is. So we're all very, very, you know, over the pace. But he still has a chance. You know, he was in the shape of his life, and he's a fit young man, and it's in God's hands at this point in time. So you know. That's where I'm at as the manager, and obviously the promoter of the fights on the night. But as I say,
Mark, go ahead. Go ahead.
So what I'm saying is, I was listening to obviously earlier on we were saying about because we're talking the sport here also about safety measures. John, you see what happened to John. This is the reality of a boxing match. It could have happened in the first round, the injury, and taken that amount of time for it to actually affect John. No one can ever say what punch caused the actual bleed to the brain. Was it the first punch? Was it the last punch? You know, and the medical procedure involved in staging a boxing match is obviously it's unbelievable. So I have to commend like the medical teams because
and at the fight on Saturday night.
Yeah.
Did the doctor on site have any cause to be concerned during the fight?
No. And what it was like because there weren't like I've been ringside to some of the biggest fights in the world and there weren't like concussive punches, if you know what I mean. It wasn't big. And anything, it would have been better if it had been a concussive punch and finished earlier. What I'm saying is there weren't really big, hard blows. It was just seemed to be an accumulation that caused the end of the fight, if that makes sense.
And yet you've revealed this morning that the referee was saying to John, if I don't see more here, I'm going to stop the fight. What was the referee concerned about? Why did he say that?
Because at that point, John was covering up on the ropes, but not throwing back. So once you, if you don't defend yourself, if you don't like, it's a boxing match. You've got to throw a punch. So if you don't throw a punch, then basically, you know, the referee will stop it because you're not giving anything back.
Mark, you know, I would be crazy not to ask this question in the context of what happened, because it is the fundamental question, or one of them. Should this fight have been stopped earlier? When you were there, and look, it's a matter of opinion, right?
Yes.
We've heard two commentators, BBC, who were working for the BBC, Anthony Kakachi and Michaela Walsh. I played the clips there. Yeah. They were both saying this fight should have been stopped earlier. Jim Neely, who has all of those decades of experience commentating and boxing, watched the same fight, and he said he saw no scenes, nothing in the fight. I think he said this to Good Morning Ulster this morning, which would have concerned him. Why is the referee not stopping this fight? He didn't see it.
Yeah.
You're John's manager.
Yeah.
Do you think the fight should have been stopped earlier than it was?
I think the corner genuinely should have, like, questioned what, if there was anything left for him to go out for the eighth or ninth round. He was well behind. He was falling behind in the fight. But ultimately, like, as I said, they know the fighter better than me. Although I'm his manager, they're with him day in, day out, and they know what John's got and what he hasn't got. I mean, the week before, I watched a fight on Sky TV. It was a guy, Conor Walker, who just fought Lewis Crocker in Birmingham. And, like, he was in a harder fight than what John Cooney was. And he was getting punched from pillar to post. And then in the last round, pulled a knockout punch and won the British and European title. So you don't know it's boxing.
Carl Frampton, obviously, one of us, boxing champion, he stressed that he didn't see the fight on Saturday night. But I was asking him more generally about the dangers that come with boxing. Let's remind ourselves of some of what he said.
More can be done in terms of nutrition. And I think a lot of the damage is done when fighters, obviously it's a weight-making sport. You know, going into weigh-ins, which are a day and a half before a fight, severely dehydrated. Sometimes a day and a half isn't enough to get yourself hydrated enough for it to be a safe level. So the Board of Control, they actually have these check weigh-ins, you know, a month out, 2 weeks out or whatever, to make sure you're in a certain distance. But I know for a fact that the fighters cheat these weigh-ins.
And we're talking generally here. We're not talking about this fight, obviously.
No, I'm not talking about this fight. I'm talking about fighters generally. So, there is ways that it could be safer. You know, people talking about head guards and stuff. I don't think head guards makes it actually safer. There's been research done to show that head guards only really stop cuts from happening, not, you know, trauma to the head or brain. But I think nutrition needs to be looked at, and I think that's where a lot of these serious injuries are kind of stemming from.
And Carl again stressing he was not talking about this fight. So many different opinions, but the focus will be, because there's a human being in intensive care after the boxing, Mark. As to just how safe is it? Can it be made safer? John's uncle, Christopher, is going further. The Belfast Telegraph reporting that he has called for a ban on professional boxing, saying, what a horrible, violent, so-called sport.
Yes.
Do you know Christopher? Do you recognise those comments?
I'm sure John is from a huge family, and we're all up at the Royal Victoria Hospital. I'll be heading back there shortly. What I'm saying is, I don't know him personally, but you have to take into consideration, like, we're, you know, every time the Isle of Man TT's on, we're waiting to see how many, like, fatalities there is, or every time that Sir Anthony McCoy got on the back of a horse and went out, you know, to ride in the Grand National. Everyone's hoping and praying, including himself, that he makes it round. If he returns home to his family, they're sportsmen, and it's a sport. You know, they're not pillow fighting. You know, it's like it's a professional sport.
Okay.
So and you're talking about safety. Let me just explain this here one thing. You see, on Saturday night, as a prime example, as I said about the medical teams, you imagine if John Cooney hadn't been assessed on site after, and had we didn't have all them teams there to take him to the Royal Victoria Hospital, and he'd have walked out of that venue, you know, and collapsed in the street. You can't get an ambulance now to take him and do. The ambulance knew what was happening. They were informed in advance of the event. And by the time, within 30 minutes, John, of leaving the Ulster Hall, John was on the operating table, and he also had an MRI scan. So, like, in terms of, like, safety, I mean, what more can you do apart from not fight each other?
Well, look, all our thoughts are with him and his family, and let's hope he pulls through. And, Mark, thanks so much for sharing time with me this morning. Thank you, sir.
Okay. Thank you very much. Cheers. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Now, next this morning, the Department of Health has told The Nolan Show that it recognises that some people may be disappointed that they're not included in the age group being offered for a free RSV vaccine this year. RSV is a common but highly infectious respiratory virus that affects the breathing system, particularly in young children and older adults. Here's the story this morning. Adults aged between 75 and 79 are offered a vaccine. But if you're over 79, if you're 80 or above, you're not offered a vaccine. And we've asked the Health Minister, Mike Nesbitt, to help us understand this. He has now said he's asking departmental officials to contact JCVI. They set the rules and vaccinations on this matter to stress the importance of the age range being kept under review. William contacted The Nolan Show. He's 81, tried to get the RSV vaccine. Here's what he's been telling me.
Yes, Stephen, it was brought to my attention last year. I think it was the National News, or it certainly was Northern Ireland News, that there was a vaccination program aimed at protecting newborns and older adults from the RSV infectious virus.
It's
a respiratory virus that affects the breathing system. And it was particularly dangerous to young children and older adults. But then when I inquired about it, I found out that it was restricted to the older adults in the category 75 to 79 years of age.
So you're 81?
So I'm 81 and I can't receive it. I'm also, according to the local clinic here, I'm CEV, which is clinically extremely vulnerable. I have had this letter in my possession since December 2020. It was because I had heart operations years ago and also prostate cancer. When I inquired to my local health office here in Cumber, they told me that they thought that there wasn't enough vaccine to cover the over 79s. So I then contacted...
That was feedback you got from the local clinic, is that right?
That's right, yes. I then contacted Mike Nesbitt's office in Newtownards and subsequently received a letter from the Department of Health, not really explaining much to me, but saying that the eligibility of the new program is based on the advice of the Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunization. And that was it. So it's not being offered to over 79 years of age. And I just was curious, why not?
Yeah.
Surely they are more at risk in the older section than the 75 to 79.
Yeah, because you would have thought the older you get, it would be a natural presumption, at least, until it's explained to you otherwise. The older you get, maybe the more vulnerable you become. But what they're doing here is restricting the availability to this to 75 to 79-year-olds. Well, why is a 79-year-old entitled to it and an 85-year-old or a 90-year-old isn't?
I don't understand. But this article has appeared twice, I think, or maybe even three times in the Newtownards Chronicle, that the RSV vaccination is in their area, and that people over 75 to 79 will be offered the vaccination.
So are they saying if someone got to their 100th birthday and all the vulnerability that comes with that level of age, that they would be prioritising a 75-year-old to a 100-year-old?
I just don't understand. I just don't understand.
We'll try to dig into this more. We've already been to the Department of Health, William, since you contacted us. They have said that, look, the criteria is being set by the JCVI. That's the Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunisation. And that would be the norm. That's a body that's set up that looks at value of medicine and who should and shouldn't get it, given the finite supply of any medicine. And they're saying that the criteria that the JCVI have come up with is whether you turn 75 on or after 1st of September 2024, whether you're aged 75 to 79, or you're aged 80, up to and including the 31st of August 2025.
it amazes me, and it's not really an answer, is it?
We'll dig a wee bit more. We'll try to get an explanation for you. Are you worried? Are you frightened?
No, I'm not concerned, but what I have done, I get my flu injection, and I at any time when it was due, I get my COVID injection because I like to protect myself as best I can.
Oh, I get it. I hear you.
And this particular one, I wouldn't like to suffer from a chest infection and end up in hospital simply because I didn't get the inoculation, the vaccination.
Well, look, do me a favour. Leave this with me. We'll get the team to work on this behind the scenes. We can talk to some doctors and things, and we'll try to get you at least some reasoning as to why this is happening, and we'll get you back with us. Is that all right?
That's fine, Stephen, yes.
Brilliant,
thanks,
William.
Thanks very much.
Enjoy your day. Thanks very much, sir.
Okay, all the best. Bye.
Well, look, we've got Dr. Chris Smith, who's a virologist at Cambridge University, presenter of The Naked Scientist. What's going on here, Chris?
Morning, Stephen.
Morning.
Well, it does seem strange, doesn't it? And the evidence is that people over the age of 80 do get RSV, respiratory syncytial virus, and they do get very ill. It's one reason why we see a lot of people in that age range in hospital in winter at this time of year. Very young kids and older people. But the evidence is that there isn't any evidence. That's the reason that they're giving. The JCVI are saying, well, in the clinical trials that were done, there was very low representation of people in their 80s. Therefore, there is a paucity of evidence that this works in these people. In a resource-limited scenario, we can therefore only make a recommendation for those we have data for. And I'm not speaking on behalf of the JCVI here. I'm just saying this is what has been passed around in various circles. There's therefore limited evidence to support its use outside that age range. Therefore, we are saying go 75 to people who you can get it when you're 80, if you're 80 in the year that you have the vaccine. But it's still daft, in my view, and lots of people are saying this. William is not alone.
But look, if there's no evidence, then that means there's no evidence against taking it.
Correct. And there is very good evidence that people who are older end up in hospital because of this. So I think it's a bit like a flu jab. And certainly it's that's judged to be a good thing to do if you're over the age of 65 in the winter. So there's not really any evidence you shouldn't do this. There is evidence that thousands of people succumb to this infection every year and end up with complications or worse. Yeah. Therefore, it would seem sensible to offer this to older people. They're more vulnerable because they're older. Age is the biggest risk factor.
And what the health minister has done since we contacted the Northern Show, contacted him, he's asked his departmental officials to contact JCVI about this and stress the importance of it being kept under review. But I think there is confusion. It was manifested by William today that saying, look, we're told to protect ourselves. He's 80, he's older than the age range, and he's trying to understand why he can't get this. And then, of course, you can get it. Guess what? Boots selling it
if you pay
for 245 quid.
Absolutely, yes.
If you're 80 or whatever age you are.
So in other words, there is not a clinical reason why a person who's over 80 can't have this. There is a financial reason why it is being offered to certain groups. And this appears to be the current thinking. And I think it's wrong. I think that we know older people are vulnerable. We know they will mount a response to this vaccine. It's a very good vaccine. It cuts down the complication rate by at least 65%, maybe as high as 80%. I'd say that's a really good idea to offer this to people who we know are at risk.
But once again, it's the haves and have-nots. Look, you know, you've got the ability to protect yourself if you're over 80, if you've got 245 quid to spare. Question, what if you don't?
Yeah, quite. And this is where I think that some of these things appear to be rather blinkered. And like I say, the JCVI are making approvals or recommendations based on evidence. If they're not presented with the evidence, they can't say, and therefore we'll rubber stamp this. And I think that probably is the problem. It's an underrepresentation. There wasn't enough recruitment into trials of people over the age of 80 to give robust statistics. Therefore, they can't say, based on statistics, we're recommending this, because they haven't got the statistics. So that says, well, we need to get more people like William and do a trial with them. And then we can show that there's robust evidence. And then they can add them to the list of approved people.
Chris, thank you very much indeed. Thank you. It's a really interesting story, that. Look, we end our programming today with our thoughts for John Cooney, who is in intensive care after his fight on Saturday night. The boxer Card Frampton was with us as a wider discussion around the safety of boxing inevitably begins now. And Card Frampton telling us that, given all the boxing that he has done over the years, yes, he does have a concern for his health in the future. He says he's not worrying about it, but he expects to get dementia in later life.
To be honest, I'm probably expecting, you know, the longevity of my career and how long I was in boxing, I'm expecting at some point that I will have dementia or some sort of brain injury, but I'm just hoping it's when I'm, you know, 75 years old and not 50.
My goodness. So you're expecting dementia because of boxing?
Probably. If you look at what's going on in the sport and the amount of former fighters that this happens to.
That's it for this morning. We'll see you tomorrow. Bye-bye.
Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet at Stephen Nolan.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like the secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru, Listen wherever you get your podcasts.